It's week 49 of the year 2020, and this is Father Roderick to the Max. Hey there, welcome back to another episode of Father Roderick to the Max. It's been a while, but if you've listened to my other podcast this week, you know that it is because of my current health situation. I am recovering from COVID, and because I've been working too hard, my whole system is kind of out of whack. So I've started occupational therapy last week, and I really have to slow down and reduce the amount of work that I do during the week, during the day. So that means that I have to sometimes juggle things around, and some things may come earlier or later than you're used to. Hopefully that's okay with you. But I'm glad to catch up. Speaking of health,
I've got a jingle. Look at the x-rays. You see that dark spot there? Whiplash.
Whiplash? Oh no.
And this smudge here that looks like my fingerprint? No, that's trauma.
So, occupational therapy, I didn't even know that that was the term. I think on The Walk, which is the other podcast that I do, I translated it by physical therapy, but that's actually not what it is. I had to look it up. Occupational therapy, according to Wikipedia, is the use of assessment and intervention to develop, recover, or maintain the meaningful activities or occupations, hence the name, of individuals, groups, or communities. It is an allied health profession performed by occupational therapists and occupational therapy assistants. So that's actually the process that I've started because I just kept having these crashes after I'd been working. I'd be unable to do anything for sometimes days afterwards. And it could be as simple as just celebrating Mass on Sunday, and then Monday, nothing. Couldn't work, had to sleep for hours during the day, no creative energy. And it's really crippling for my work because I'm still, as you know, working against all these TV deadlines. So it's I cannot continue like this. So I went to see my physician, and the doctor said, I'm going to prescribe occupational therapy because this is not going to cure itself. Which proved to be the right thing to do because I had my intake last week and went over all the symptoms that I have and the current situation. And what if there was one big conclusion to that entire conversation was, you're doing way too much. You have to make some serious cuts in your workload. And then we're going to bring in another therapist, another type of therapist. I had to look that one up too. It's called an ergotherapist. See, I'm learning so much these days. Ergotherapy is the use of an appropriate amount of physical exertion as a treatment for disease. So that basically means someone who helps me to look at what I do, and that can be just regular work, can also be creative work, social interaction, all that is asking energy, of course. Even social interaction, even podcasting costs energy. And so what the ergotherapist is going to do is to look at all that and then help me distribute it over the day and make sure that I get a sufficient amount of rest and that I learn to listen to the signals that my body gives. And one of the reasons that I wanted to get some help in that is it's always difficult to do your own assessment. And I don't know when to push myself and when to slow down, what is dangerous and what is not. So I was, for instance, very worried about my heart rate. Like this morning, I had to go pretty early to one of our parish churches that is almost half an hour by car, which for me is kind of far. The Mass starts at 9 o'clock in the morning, so I got to wake up pretty early. And I noticed that throughout the morning, while I was getting ready to step into my car and to drive to that parish church, my heart rate was constantly over 100. And so I have this smartwatch, and I programmed it so that it will warn me when my heartbeat goes over 100. Before COVID, my heart rate was about 50 or sometimes even lower. I was in very good shape. So the fact that my heart rate is much higher means that the body is like, oh, we got to wake up. We got to do so much now. And it could be dangerous. At least that's what I'm afraid of because it's my heart, right? It's different from, I don't know, a headache or something like that. So I don't want to overly put pressure on my, you know, my heart and that entire system. So that's just one of the symptoms. I've got some other stuff that I'm dealing with as well. Fortunately, thankfully, there's nothing wrong with my lungs. So I have no trouble breathing, which is one of the symptoms that a lot of other people struggle with, even weeks or months after having contracted COVID. It's this shortness of breath. I do have shortness of breath whenever I do physical exercise, but it's not because of my lungs. It's probably because I'm completely out of shape after all these weeks. My itinerary started beginning of September, and we're now in December. So that probably has taken quite a toll on the entire system. So we need to build up physical strength. I need to reorganize my days. And the hardest thing I did yesterday, and that was to say no to a ton of obligations and commitments. And so I had to really think out of the box. What can I truly stop for a while? What can I change? Are there different ways of kind of like taking off the workload or distribute it over some other people? So I'll probably get some help in that area as well. So, but having to go back to the people that I work with and work for and telling them, well, I can't do what I promised to do. That is the hardest thing, because I just don't want to disappoint anyone. But as one of my board members said, it's like a pyramid. If you don't build the base, if the pyramid is upside down, which it currently is, and you have only a little bit of energy and you try to do this ton of stuff, it's gonna crumble at one point, and it will not be good quality work either. So focus on the base first and then build it up again. People will understand. So that's what I hope. But gosh, admitting to yourself and to other people that you can't do what your mind tells you to do, that's the hardest part of this whole process. But I'm glad that I can share it, so at least you know what's going on. And maybe it can also help some other people that are in the same boat. This morning I spoke with the musical director of the church where I was celebrating Mass. And he had sent me a couple of weeks ago, when I went there for Mass, like the day after, he sent an email. He said, "Hey, I've just been diagnosed with COVID, and I've been in your vicinity," because we were talking about the chants and whatnot. And so he warned me. And then this morning he was there. So I asked him, "What's going on? How are you doing?" Well, he said, I've had some mild symptoms, not as bad as you had, but I still don't have any sense of smell or taste. I can't taste anything." So I told him, make sure that you don't go back to work as if nothing happened. That was my mistake. Don't make the same mistake. And if you still have if your sense of taste is not there, it means that's neurological, of course. That's your brain doing that. Your tongue hasn't changed. It's just that your brain doesn't process the signals in the same way it did before COVID. That is a symptom, you could say, of a deregulation. So it means you're not healthy yet. And the only way to get healthy, at least right now for me, is to slow down and to give my body, my whole system, even my brain, ample rest. Another thing that the therapist already announced, which I was like, oh, I don't know if I want this, if I can do this. She said, you're going to see that the other therapist, the ergotherapist, will prescribe several moments during the day, and these can be long moments of stimulus. Like moments without any stimuli. And then she immediately said, so no mobile devices, no screens, no social media, no television, no video games. What? That is my life. So, oh well. Maybe it helps if someone else who has really studied for this tells me this with authority, maybe that will make it easier. But even if I rest now, I always take my iPad with me to just read or listen to an audiobook. But she was talking about, like, close your eyes, no music, nothing, just silence. Meditation. Breathing exercises. Oh, my goodness. I'm going to be a monk for the next couple of months. I don't know if I can deal with that. Oh, well. So, for me, it seems like Lent is starting early. So that was my update. That's how things are going. Fortunately, I have moments that I feel good and that I'm relaxed, and especially, you know, a chat like this. That's actually invigorating. That gives me, I enjoy, I know that it still takes away energy, so I need to rest afterwards, but it also gives me a lot of joy. And joy is also very good medication when you're not feeling that well. So thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to experience some joy. Another thing that I need to really be careful with is what I eat, and in my case, how much I eat. That was one of the things that the therapist asked me. So how's your weight? Because most of the time, people will lose weight when they're sick. And that happened to me too. When I've been in bed for 3 weeks with high fevers and stuff. So after those 3 weeks, I lost about between 3 and 4 kilograms, which is 8 pounds. That's a lot. I never pulled that off before COVID. But then I started eating again, and now I'm back to normal. And in fact, it is increasing because I don't run anymore. I don't walk. Well, I do walk a little bit, but just very short distances. So right now I can walk for about 45 minutes before, and then I start to get tired and out of breath. I hardly bike. My only physical exercise that is serious is when I film. When I go out to film for a day, because then I'm running around with a camera and a tripod. And, oh, well, if you've ever seen the behind-the-scenes stuff on YouTube, how I film my documentaries, I'm always running around. But that's just one day out of seven. So that's not going to cut it. And my problem is that I'm also, I think, overcompensating a little bit with food because, well, these are stressful times, and so you're trying to kind of soothe yourself with food. So I eat more than I usually eat. And of course, well, the result is there's more of me than there should be. So that's also going to be a challenge in the next couple of weeks to make sure that I eat what I should eat and not overeat. And secondly, of course, that I eat healthy stuff that is going to, now that I'm going to do physical exercises again, probably need to switch a bit more to protein-based food, because that will help build up muscle mass. But then, of course, if you eat too much protein-rich food without exercise, it's not going to be good. So prepare to hear some different types of recipes than the usual pasta stuff that I've been talking about lately. Just an update on what I've been cooking this week. This is one of those times in the year that we can eat mussels. There's only a few months during the year. I think there has to be an M in the name of the month. So November, December, you can get mussels. March, May, I don't know. There are just a few months during the year that they actually sell mussels in the supermarket. So I got myself a big plastic, I hate it, everything is in plastic, but anyway, beats going out there with my nets, fishing them up myself, of mussels. And I don't know if you've ever prepared mussels. It's actually quite simple, but it's laborious. So you have all these black mussels, and most of them are closed or almost closed. The thing is, during the whole transport of those mussels to the stores, there are always a few of them, after all, they're living animals, right, that are dying. And if you cook those and eat those, you can get very, very sick. So the trick is, you have to test every mussel individually to see if it's alive. And the way in which you can see if they are alive, is that they are closed when you wash them. So you put them in cold water, and then most of them will close, and you can't open them because it's, you know, it's the muscle that puts these two halves of the shell together. But then there are also a few muscles that are open, and even if you wash them, they will stay slightly open. That still doesn't mean that they're dead. Then you just have to kind of knock on the shell and then wait for a few seconds, and then most of them will also still close. They were like, oh, what's going on there? Okay, let's just close store. But then there are also a few of them that remain open, or damaged ones that are like, are they alive or not? Let's not take any risks. So usually I end up with like 80% is alive. But then a few are clearly dead. And then there are some of these that are, you don't know actually if they're alive or dead. And then the process itself, pretty simple. You take a big pan, like a vertically tall pan, fill it with a bit of water, put the mussels in there. And then I usually add also some veggies, so some leek, onions, carrot, and then some herbs. Can just be some salt and pepper, and I just add whatever I want to experiment with. And then you put that on a fire, and then it cooks, of course. And it's basically, you're steaming the thing, the pan. And then it usually goes very quickly. As soon as the water is boiling, then you will get that steam, and I leave it there for a couple of minutes. Then I lower the fire until everything, you know, kind of calms down, and then I heat it up another time just to be sure. And then usually all the mussels will have opened, and the color of the meat will be orange or pink. And then it's not very heavy as a meal, even though it's usually a big pan, but the actual amount of food is very small because these mussels are not that big. So you kind of, I take a fork, take them out, and I usually make some sauces with, based with mayonnaise, sometimes aioli. You can add some ketchup to mayonnaise, mix that up. Some curry powder. I usually make like three or four sauces, and that's, of course, the least healthy part of the meal. And if you really want to do it in the Belgian way, you have to make fries as well. When I made the mussels, I didn't have any potatoes in the house, or so I just skipped the fries. But this reminds me of, like, the reason that from time to time I eat mussels is that when I was doing my retreat before my ordination as a deacon, a transitional deacon, usually before ordination you go on a retreat for a week. And I was on retreat with seven other candidates. And we went to Belgium to a monastery. And we weren't completely cloistered, so we did go out to eat in the neighboring restaurants. And it was a very small village, looked like nothing. And there was this one restaurant that we could find. This was even before social media and before you could look that up on the internet. I didn't have I think I had a mobile phone, but definitely no internet on that phone. That's how long ago it was. And but we saw this, and we were wondering, is this really a restaurant or not? We saw that there was a sign on the door, but the rest just looked like a regular house with curtains and everything. So we enter, and it just looks like a living room. It was almost like, are we intruding? No, please sit down. And there were just two or three tables. It was super tiny. And basically the owner of the house was cooking in the kitchen for customers. And we were the only customers. So we asked what was on the menu. And she said, today, there's no menu. Today we eat mussels with fries. And that's what she prepared for us. And it was, I will never forget that. It was cold outside. I remember that. This was towards the end of the year, I think. Or was it early in the year? I don't know. It was just freezing cold outside. It was already dark. It was misty in that village. We were sitting in that small room with these hot plates of, you know, not French fries, of course, Belgium fries, these thicker ones with mayonnaise. And then there was a whole plethora of sauces in which we would dip these mussels. And it just kept coming. There was no, like, fixed limit. There was basically all the mussels. We ate every one of them. And it was so good. And I always cherish that memory because it was such a, just an unexpected experience. And it was the only thing that I actually remember of that retreat, which is probably not very, it's not helping my canonization. But it was a lot of fun. And being there together, it's just one of those experiences that you will always later on share when you meet each other and talk about the days of lore. And then for our priestly ordination, we were in a totally different part of the world. We were in the northern part of the country in a monastery near the sea. So what did we do? Halfway through the week, we went to eat mussels. But it was nothing compared to what we had in Belgium. This was in a regular restaurant, and it wasn't very good. It was just for tourists. But it's just one of these things that every time I eat mussels, I think of those, you know, those days of preparation for ordination. It's such a weird thing. Okay, enough about mussels. There are two other things that I want to mention here briefly. So I still haven't done anything for the new kitchen upstairs. That's probably going to take a few more months before that is ready. So I'm still cooking here downstairs. I made some pumpkin soup the other day, which was actually quite nice. And I think if you listen to the walk, I'm not sure if it was this week or the week before. That's when I get the idea, because I'm recording in the supermarket and I see some pumpkin stuff and it's like, hey, I can make pumpkin soup. I love pumpkin soup. There's something about that taste that is so, for this time of year, it's super comfy. Comfy soup. Isn't it pumpkin, also pumpkin spice, the big thing in North America during the winter months? Like, everything is pumpkin and flavored, which is kind of weird because I associate pumpkin with hearty food, whereas I think in North America, correct me if I'm wrong, they have pumpkin spice lattes and stuff like that, and pumpkin pie. And the thing is, I've never done anything sweet with pumpkin, so I need you for some recipes. If there are, even the regular ones, I just want to try that out, because I love pumpkin, but I wouldn't know where to start. And if you type in pumpkin recipes, you get like tens of thousands of videos, and I don't know where to start. But I'm sure that there are some staple pumpkin recipes next to pumpkin pie, because I can't bake. I don't have an oven. But if there's anything else I can do, like the pumpkin coffee stuff, how do I do that? Is that even real? Is that using real pumpkin, or is it just something that they call pumpkin, but it's not? I don't know. Let me know by posting on social media, or let me know in the Discord server. We have a kitchen in the Discord server. So I'm just going to put up a question there too. If people have any, you know, pumpkin flavored North American recipes, I'm eager to try out some of them. And then the second thing, I finally figured out how to not have my oatmeal explode. This is one of the things that kept me from eating oatmeal for years. It is this thing that happened. This is years ago. I think it was one of the first Catholic New Media conferences that I organized, or we organized. And so people from all over America came to a city. I think maybe this was in Boston. I don't remember. We were in this hotel, and they had the instant oatmeal, which I think you only needed to add water to it. I think it was from Quakers, the brand. Anyway, and it had all sorts of flavored. It looked like fun. I'd never eaten oatmeal, at least not in that you know, instant stuff, and definitely not. But maybe it was even pumpkin spiced or whatever. So I remember I put that in the bowl. Add water. Just following instructions. Put it in a microwave, and I put it on. What was it? 3 minutes. And then I'm talking to one of the other guests, and all of a sudden I hear poof. and I look at the window of the microwave, and it's just oatmeal dripping from the ceiling of the thing. And I open the microwave, and the entire microwave is covered in globs of oatmeal. I was like, oh my goodness. And of course, this was in a hotel, so I didn't, you know, normally if this would happen at home, I would clean it up. But I was looking around, and fortunately someone came and helped me clean it. But I felt so embarrassed because lots of people were waiting to use the microwave, and I had just caused a small seismic event inside that thing, and I didn't know what I did wrong until I got my own microwave back at home, and I tried to prepare oatmeal in the microwave, and it did the same thing. It would just explode. And not once, but every time I tried to make oatmeal, I had to basically look at it constantly, which is always hard because there is a like a frame or whatever, like a metal grill in front of the window with these tiny holes in it. So you can't really look. You have to keep moving your head to get a clear focus on what's happening inside. And then the moment I see the bubbling and the all of a sudden it's like a volcano. The oatmeal starts to rise. I immediately press stop. But then it's not ready yet. It's still very liquid. So I had to press it again. And then after 20 seconds, it would start to rise again, like ready for an explosion. Then stop it again. I just gave up. I was like, oh, this is not working. I had a similar problem, by the way, with popcorn. Like, remember... I remember this is probably just a reality for most normal people. They make popcorn in a microwave. You have these this foil stuff, and you basically place it in the middle of the microwave. You put the timer on, and then 3 minutes later, you've got wonderful popcorn. Not my microwave. It would just completely burn. It would be smoke and fire and whatnot. That entire... I've never been able to make microwave popcorn, ever. And so, I gave up on that, too. And then I now have a microwave, which is like second or third hand. It's one of my predecessors who left it here. It's a super simple, small one, completely incomprehensible user interface. So you have to press buttons, and there's no relationship between the symbols on the buttons and on what it does. I have no idea. There's no manual. Probably could Google it, but I'm too lazy and I'm a geek, so I don't do that. But I'm just pressing some buttons. And lo and behold, my oatmeal comes out perfectly after 3 minutes. Just 3 minutes. And I don't know what I do, but I know the sequence of buttons that I push. I'm not going to change that. And now what I want to try is microwave popcorn. Because if oatmeal does not explode, then maybe I hit the jackpot. And I finally have found a microwave that works for me without causing explosions or fires or, you know, huge clouds of black smoke that emerge from the crusty remains of what should have been popcorn. And I don't know how it happens. I can only be thankful. It's just, you know, it's a gift of God. Zena in the chat says, maybe the oatmeal needs to be at a lower heat for a longer time. So it is that is probably it, Zena. I think you cracked the mystery. It's a very simple, cheap microwave, so it's probably just lower wattage. Whereas I know that my previous one was pretty like 850 watts or something. I was like, it could heat up stuff so quickly. Maybe that's what happened. Maybe the hotel was the same thing. It was just a super powerful microwave. And this one is just a cheap Chinese, you know, knockoff that is just not good enough. But it's good enough for oatmeal. Who knows? Anywho. So I'm when I now cook, sorry for extending the kitchen segment, but I use regular oats. I never do the instant stuff because it's loaded with sugar, and I don't like all those extra flavors. I just like regular oatmeal. So I think it's called steel cut oats. Yes. But it does take some time. Someone else warns me to avoid pumpkin spiced coffee. Oh no, it's lots of around. It's not to avoid it. So anyway, this was the jingle for what I've learned this week. And you know that I'm a pupil of the TikToks. After having installed TikTok, I first thought, this is not for me. This is for kids, you know. It's just dancing and karaoke things, or people, pretending they're singing. But TikTok is a massive treasure trove of knowledge. And I'm following lots of scientists, like psychologists and scientists, chemists. I'm following chemistry. Was the nail in my coffin in high school. I hated chemistry. I didn't understand it. I was like, why? Why, God? Why do I have to do chemistry? But now I'm following a chemist, and it's just a guy who is a great teacher. And the way he explains it is like, if I had him as a teacher, maybe I would have been a chemist by now instead of a priest. So I love learning. And that's the cool thing about TikTok. It knows what I like to see. So it's constantly feeding me new people to discover, new stuff. And if I don't like it, I just swipe it away and I'm not bothered by it anymore. And it will present me stuff in another direction. So I love how that algorithm is constantly presenting me with new stuff to try. And some of it sticks and some of it doesn't. And I feel so free to just like subscribe to some people, which I never do on YouTube or let alone on Facebook, because I know that if you start following the wrong people, then very quickly you get a super polluted timeline and then it's no fun anymore. And then it takes a lot of effort to kind of sanitize your timeline. But with TikTok, for some reason, I just like, oh, this is a great person, or I love this. And then it's because it's, you cannot really subscribe. Well, you can actually, but you when you first start using TikTok, it's just the algorithm that tries out stuff. So I was always afraid that if I watched an interesting explanation, you can't bookmark it or anything. So I started following these people, and I noticed that the more I follow people, the better the algorithm understands me and knows what I want to learn. It's insane. So I even created my own segment, and of course, this shouldn't be just about TikTok, but that's where I currently get a lot of knowledge. I want to pass it on. I want to let you share in it, and in the show notes, I will include the screen names of the TikTokers, so if you are on TikTok too, you can check them out. So, what did I learn? Why the Mona Lisa is such a famous painting? Like, I would never, ever voluntarily go Google art or history of the arts or whatever, or explanation of modern art. Here I was just browsing through stuff, and all of a sudden there's this young lady, and she's like, hey, I am an art expert, and I'm going to explain this picture to you, this painting to you. And it was like a hideous painting, and I was like, that's not my type of art. But then I get the explanation, and I'm like, I'm completely mesmerized, like, whoa, I had no idea. I want to know more. Subscribe. And then now, every once in a while, I get these explanations of other paintings, and there's sometimes it's a very factual explanation of the how to interpret paintings. Sometimes it is history of a certain painting. And so this was an interesting video. Her theory was that Mona Lisa is not just famous because of the mysterious smile that we all associate, of course, with Mona Lisa. But the fact that it is now one of the best known paintings in the world is because it has been stolen. And for years, nobody knew where that painting was. And when they finally found the painting and brought it back to the museum, this was headline news all over the world. It was on the front pages of every printed journal. And according to her, that is probably part of why this is such a well-known painting. Like everybody who visited Paris now wanted to see that painting that was that is so beautiful and was once stolen. I remember the first time I went to the Louvre in Paris to see the Mona Lisa with my own eyes. I was super disappointed. I expected a massive painting, you know, like that would cover the entire wall, like the Night Watch in our Rembrandt area of the museum in Amsterdam. Instead, it was this tiny little thing, you know. If this would hang in IKEA, I wouldn't even notice it. It was small, and I remember there were a lot of people around it taking pictures, and this is really so underwhelming, but I was still thrilled to have seen it with my own eyes. But I would never really go to the Louvre just to see the Mona Lisa. And from what I've heard, it's even worse now because there's so many people crammed into that room. You hardly can get anywhere near the painting. So that was the first thing I learned. The second thing I learned, and this shows you how eclectic this whole TikTok experience is, I learned what beds looked like in the Middle Ages. Like, I would never Google that stuff, but here it is. It's a mini report on, you know, did you ever know that beds in the Middle Ages looked like this or looked like this? And then you see total opposites. You see this huge, you know, beautiful bed with curtains, and you can even close the curtains around the bed. Stuff from fairy tales. But then you also see like a simple plank with some straw and stuff, and it's the rest of the house is even worse. And then it goes on to explain that the beds were actually the piece of furniture that people valued the most in, especially around, you know, the year 1000 and 1100. And the reason that people invested so much in their beds and not in the rest of the furniture is that basically that was the single piece of furniture that they used the most. People lived outside. And so for the night, you want to be in a comfortable position and you want to be warm. And that turns out to be the biggest influencer on what the beds looked like. And it's something that I never realized, but it makes so much sense. When you see these big beds, when you visit Versailles in France, you see the royal palace, and you see this bed. It has curtains all around, and I just thought that was decoration, but of course not. That has a function. When you're in bed, you close the curtains so it keeps the heat inside. There was no central heating. If you were lucky and rich, you would have a fireplace. But even in most houses, you couldn't keep the fire burning throughout the night, because then you have to get up and add wood to the fire. So most people, during the night, it was just stone cold. And so that's why people would spend a lot of money on their beds, so at least they could be warm during the night. And even in poor house, in, you know, in a poorer population, they would have beds that were reasonably comfortable. And later on, they would even build like boxes, and the bed was inside the box. I've seen those beds in old farms in my first parish. I remember visiting a parishioner that showed me. They had renovated an old farm that was like 2 centuries old. And I remember the parishioner said that the thing that she loved the most was that there was still an original, I think that she even called it a box bed. And it was super tiny because people were a lot smaller back then, especially now compared to the giants that we have walking around here in the Netherlands, in comparison to which I always feel like a hobbit. But anyway, it's a tiny little bed, and it was literally in a box. Of course, there was a bit of ventilation, but all that, I was like, wow, why don't we have beds like that anymore? For a child, it must be wonderful to have your own little cabin. But of course, it makes sense. It was just to keep the heat inside. Well, that is just, I'm talking about it for 5 minutes now, but that was in a 1 minute video on TikTok. And I was, subscribe. I want to hear more of those completely, irrelevant factoids. But I love that. What else did I learn? Oh, there is one guy that I discovered on TikTok. It's totally up my alley. It's the obscure Lord of the Rings facts guy. That's his name, the obscure Lord of the Rings facts guy. And every video is, hey, let me tell you another obscure fact of the Lord of the Rings. And sometimes it's about the movie, sometimes it's about the books, about characters, about certain situations, sometimes a bit of backstory. And some of these things are not that obscure. If you're more than just an occasional Tolkien fan, you will sometimes have heard of these things, but I've also learned a lot of new things. And what I like is that sometimes it's tiny little details, you know, remember this one event and this phrase and, but did you know that? And then you get a whole explanation. I love it. The guy himself, I think his real name is Don Marshall, was super surprised that it became such a hit because he just posted a video and it looks so terrible. I mean, he's using this fake green screen stuff and it's, oh, visually TikTok is a total mess, but that's why it works because it's focusing on the content, not on the form. And there's something refreshing about all these videos. Just anyone can do TikToks as long as you've got a story to tell that's interesting or information to convey. So his first video got only like 50 views and then the next one just blew up and in a week time he got like 50,000 followers. That's insane. And I understand because he brings something to the table that no one else does. So I was like very much tempted to start a channel on TikTok called the Obscure Star Wars Fact Guy Priest whatever. But then I remembered what my occupational therapist said. No extra work. See what work you can get rid of. And there I'm sitting like, but TikTok, no. Someone else will have to do that. Oh, boy. And then there's another person that I'm following, which also fascinating. His screen name is Ryder Chitwood. And he is actually someone who works in the movie industry. And his videos are stories from the set. Now, of course, I work in a different field, but in the similar, you know, in the same industry. I'm making TV, I make documentaries, which is very different, of course, from theatrical movies. But it's still, there are a lot of technical aspects and just organizational aspects that are similar. So I'm learning a lot from this guy. And he works also on pretty, you know, big budget movies that he signed NDAs for. So, but he tells the stories without identifying which movie that relates to. And again, this would never be sanctioned, I think, in official media surrounding a movie. But on TikTok, this is possible. And this also probably wouldn't fly on YouTube because the stories are very short and YouTube rewards videos that are like 10 minutes or longer. So I love these stories. And there's one particular story that I was like laughing out loud when I heard it. So he's filming this movie with children actors. And I have worked sometimes with kids and it's so difficult because kids are basically like, well, look at Baby Yoda or Grogu. You cannot control children. They do what they do and you just have to pray that they don't mess up your plans. So they are trying to film this dramatic. This is in a, you know, a fictional story. This kid has to react to the news that his parents are getting a divorce. But of course, the kid has read the script and knows that the thing that he needs to react to is a divorce. And the actors are not his parents, right? So first few takes, almost no reaction. It is, it doesn't work. It's not believable. The kid tries to give an honest, like lifelike reaction, but it's completely outside the scope of the experience of this child. So it doesn't work. And then this Chitwood guy is like, how can we make this work? Or maybe it wasn't him, but someone else. Maybe he wasn't even the director. And then they come up with this devious plan, and it's evil. And if small kids are listening to this, cover their ears, because this is, it's not going to be gross or anything, but this is, they do something that you shouldn't do to kids. And that is, so for the next take, they look at this boy. The director tells the kid, I have to tell you something, and you're not going to like it. The tooth fairy doesn't exist. It's made up by your parents. Cameras are rolling. And this child is like starting to cry and everything is completely in shock. And then the director is cut. We got it. This is it. And then they've got the perfect take because the reaction is genuine. This child is shocked to learn that the tooth fairy is fake. And, oh, it's so evil. And afterwards, apparently, there's been this massive conflict between the parents of the child actor and the director. It's like, it's our kid. You robbed our kid from something precious. And we got to take stories like that. Where do you hear stories like that? So anyway, again, I'll post the screen names in the show notes on Patreon if you want to check out these particular feeds. There's so many more channels, but in order to hear about those, you may have to come back to another episode of Father Roderick to the Max.
I'm quite keen on comic books, especially the ones about superheroes. I find the whole mythology surrounding superheroes fascinating.
You ever try these comics?
No.
You know something?
No, what?
You read too many comic books.
I know that I'm a huge fan of comic books or superhero comics, Marvel universe, all that. But I'm also super curious about the Snyder Cut of the Justice League movie, which is going to be only available to HBO subscribers, which I'm not. So I hope that they won't wait too long to publish this on Blu-ray or whatever. But from what I've seen, this is going to be a totally different story, and hopefully a lot better than what we ended up seeing in theaters, which was, I liked it, actually, but it was also a bit meh, especially compared to what Marvel was doing with their stories. Now, the thing with Marvel is the movies are great. I hope that their TV show, the WandaVision show, that I think is going to premiere anytime now on Disney Plus, is going to be also good. I really hope that they can match the level of quality that we're getting with The Mandalorian. I think that they can't really go, you know, give us a subpar thing. Even, I mean, I've heard The Shield is very good, but it's definitely not The Mandalorian. So I'm hoping that with WandaVision, we're getting something special. But then there is also the domain of video games that are based on comic books. And I think a while ago I mentioned this Marvel game based on Marvel Heroes that apparently has a very good solo campaign, but then there is almost no reason to play it again. And the multiplayer component is very, very weak. And it was a full price game, so, you know, if a game doesn't get good ratings, and apparently, from what I've heard, almost no one is playing that game anymore. But just lately, for Black Friday, they've been cutting the price in half. So it's now around $25. And I'm so on the fence with this, because I loved playing the demo the open beta. And I thought it was so cool, especially because it almost felt like watching a Marvel movie. And remember, we haven't had any Marvel movies this year. So I'm a little bit starving here on the level of, you know, getting my superhero fix. So I don't know. If any of you has played that game, let me know if it's worth $25 or not. Because I'd love to play it. It looks so cool. But on the other hand, I've sometimes in the past bought games not full price. Rarely, I think only Halo. I think I bought it full price, but I rarely buy anything full price. But even if I paid like $25 or something, if the game is really not that good, it still feels like a waste of money. So let me know if any of you has more experience with that game, whether it's worth my time or not. It really needs to go back to Animal Crossing also, because winter is coming, also in Animal Crossing. And so you get snowy landscapes. Last time I played it was like 3 months ago, before I got COVID. It was still the beginning of the fall season. I was planting pumpkins. Well, that, of course, is long gone. But I almost fear to go back to my island because it's probably just a mess because I haven't been there in a long time. But maybe we should get in touch if some of you are playing Animal Crossing. We got to hook up on, you know, the friends level there and just visit each other's islands or something like that. I need some more social pressure to work on my island again. Maybe I can squeeze that into my therapy. That it's a very, yes, it's a screen, but it's also very relaxing and diversion from my worries. Maybe it has a calming effect on me. Who knows? WandaVision, by the way, is January 2021, according to someone in the chat. Thank you. So, liturgy. I'm recording this on the Feast of St. Nicholas, which you may have heard that from actually some of my other posts or maybe stuff from the past. He is very important in the Netherlands. It's the most popular saint in the Netherlands. St. Nicholas, patron saint of Amsterdam. I filmed an entire documentary about the traces of St. Nicholas in Amsterdam. It's fascinating. Definitely going to do an international version of that if I get the time to do that. But while I was filming that, I saw something amazing. I never thought I'd see that. Normally, if you want to go pray with the relics of St. Nicholas, you have to go all the way to Bari in Italy. This is because St. Nicholas, of course, was from Myra, which is current-day Turkey. But then, at one point, and I forgot what era that was, they plundered the city where they venerated his body and brought his remains to Italy, where they built a church around his relics, and that's Bari in Italy, it's south of Italy. I've never been there. Heard a lot of good things about it. But there's not an easy connection. You have to travel to Rome, then take the train for about 5 hours, I think, to get there. So I've never had the courage to go there and film. But in Amsterdam, the main basilica, which is, I think it's the biggest Catholic church of Amsterdam. It's, well, maybe not. Or maybe it is. I don't know. It's a huge church next to Central Station, a railway station. Very different style of the railway station, but still very interesting, very pompous, big building. Very impressive church, in my opinion. And the thing is, they venerated St. Nicholas there for centuries. This started probably in the Middle Ages, and there have been several churches dedicated to St. Nicholas, and this is the last one. The thing is, there is no relic of St. Nicholas there, and a parishioner took the initiative to go search for one or hunt for one, which is hard because there's only one St. Nicholas, and there are a lot of people that would like to have a relic of him and a lot of churches in the world that are named after him. I did some research, and it turns out that in the late Middle Ages, in the northern part of the Netherlands, which back then was a lot bigger than it is now, there were around 900 churches that were dedicated to St. Nicholas. Goes to show how popular he was back then, and in a way still is. The patron saint of the seafarers, for instance. And, well, we're a seafaring nation. So she ultimately ended up finding a relic in a monastery, actually the same monastery where I did my retreat before I was ordained a priest. Same monastery. Turns out they have a treasure of relics, and they are now giving a relic of St. Nicholas to the Basilica, the St. Nicholas Basilica in Amsterdam. And I got to see it. I got to film it. So cool. It was a tiny little box that actually the monks created. They made that for the Basilica, but it looks like something from the Middle Ages. It's a very beautiful little bronze container. And if you open it on the inside, you see a piece of a bone, just white, like a fragment, but it was much bigger than most relics you see in churches. Most relics is just a tiny little chip, you know, it's like a millimeter or something like that. This was clearly, you know, we could identify it as part of a skeleton. I would say it's about 2 inches long, 1 inch thick. And they had a pathologist, is that the word? Look at it and examine it. And because they, especially when we're talking about very old saints, and St. Nicholas, of course, is early church, it's very hard to determine the veracity of those stories and of those relics. But in this case, the pathologist said that it was clearly very old, probably more than 1,000 years old. I don't think they did any carbon dating on it, but, you know, a relic that is that old doesn't usually survive without a very good reason for it. So the documentation around that relic dates back to, you know, the year 1000. So that's pretty serious. Not many relics, not often do relics come with such a paper trail that dates back to the Middle Ages. And the other thing that the pathologist could deduce was that it was probably either from the cheek or a collarbone or something like that. No, the shoulder blade. It will be placed in the basilica for veneration at a later moment. They wanted to do that today, actually, on the feast of St. Nicholas, but then a very prominent chorist of the cathedral died from COVID. And the funeral is, I think, tomorrow or something like that. But everybody was mourning and shocked, so they didn't want to have a big celebration, understandably. So instead, I think it will be in February. Actually, I know when it is going to be, on the feast of St. Valentine. Which is cool because St. Valentine is also venerated in the same part of Italy. Well, same part, more or less. But it was so cool. The thing is, the pilgrims will only see the shrine, the small shrine that the monks made. They will not get to see the actual relic. But I was there like inches away filming it for my TV show. I was like, how lucky am I to be here near a relic of what used to be and still is one of my favorite saints, and a great example, because St. Nicholas was also the patron saint for the poor, for the prostitutes, for, you know, people in need, and a very, I think, relevant example for our times, where there's also so much poverty, and where, you know, our current Pope Francis is always encouraging us to listen to the voice of the poor, because it's the voice of Jesus himself. So anyway, that's what I wanted to share with you in this liturgy section. A few loose ends to wrap up before I stop the show and take some rest. This morning I discovered the coolest thing ever in Lego. Now, you know that currently Lego is selling a model of the Colosseum in Rome. I think it is currently their biggest set in terms of pieces. Definitely not as impressive as, for instance, the Millennium Falcon, which you're really building, very detailed construction with all sorts. But this is the Colosseum. So it's an architectural build. So, of course, you're going to have a lot of stones because it's a big stone building. But it looks amazing. Super expensive. It's hundreds and hundreds. I think it's like $500 or more. So not something you will just buy for fun. But beautiful. But then this morning, I saw a photo in my timeline from a guy, and I think he's Italian, Rocco Buttigliere, who built in Lego the entirety of Vatican City, not just St. Peter's Basilica. There are quite a few sets of St. Peter's Basilica out there. Well, not real sets, but mocks, as they call them, so builds by fans. But this is the entire country, including the walls, including the all the buildings, the Pope Paul VI Hall, the garden, the radio tower, Santa Marta, where the Pope lives. Even the new entrance is there. You've got the observatory. It's all there, and it is done so well. I've never, ever seen such an amazing build. And now I want to get to know this guy because I want to see this with my own eyes. So according to, so he posted a few photos on Flickr, and if you want to look them up, I'll post a link in the show notes on Patreon. According to the description here on Flickr, it is the world's first contiguous Lego landscape of an entire sovereign country. 67,000 parts, 1,300 of them are unique. I mean, that's just mind-boggling. 67,000 parts. The scale is 1 to 650. The dimensions are much smaller than I thought from seeing the picture. It's 52 inches and 68 inches. So in centimeters, this is 131 centimeters by 173 centimeters. So this is basically something that I could have in my living room, that I want to have in my living room. Design time, 500 hours. Took him 70 days to design this. And then he built it in 300 hours. Took him a month, 28 days to build it. Totally amazing. I hope that this guy lives in Italy, because when COVID is over and he still has it and hasn't deconstructed it, God forbid that he deconstructs this. I want to go travel to wherever this guy lives and I want to interview him. I want to make a documentary about this. This is the coolest Lego thing I've ever seen. And of course, it's never going to be an official set because Lego has this policy of never giving out sets of religious buildings, which I think is ridiculous, but it's Denmark. I don't know. It's a choice. Playmobil does do that, and they have churches that you can buy. And I think they're just missing out on the market, but I guess it's their way of staying out of controversial stuff. But now that I've seen this, I think there are a lot of people that would pay a hefty price to be able to build Vatican City, especially if you see how beautiful this is. So again, if you haven't seen this on Facebook, then make sure to go to Patreon. In the show notes, I'll include a link to the Flickr photos. And that was it. That was it. I'm done with my list of topics. So thank you so much for the privilege of your time. Hope you stay healthy, and hopefully next week I'll have the energy and the time to record another episode of Father Roderick to the Max. Thanks for being a patron. Thanks for your support, for your prayers, and thanks for your time.